Okay, so my name is Marcy Okada, and I work for the National Park Service, and we are here with Randy Brown, and today's May 2nd, 2023, and we also have...
Matt Sarm from Wildlife Biosphere 4, Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve.
Okay, and we're here today to interview Randy about his sheep hunting experiences in Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. But we'll go ahead and also just do introductions. Questions about how Randy first got into the country on the Yukon River.
Okay, yeah, this is Randy Brown. And I came to Alaska right after high school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and went to the university for one semester and then milked cows down in the Palmer-Wasilla area for the second half of the winter, because I really wanted to move out in the woods, and then made my way to Eagle the next summer. And one of my friends from high school, Charles Brunn, he came up with me. We used to go camping and hiking around in the mountains in northern New Mexico a lot. So we were going to go down. We had picked out Totonic River as the place we wanted to go to live, and on topo maps from down in New Mexico. And so we went down there and met Dick Cook, who said, no, you can't move in here. He had a place a little below the mouth of the Totonic River, and then another one about 5 miles up on a little island just downstream from Pass Creek. And he said, go explore whatever you want, but you can't come and move in here, and so it's too close. You'll have to find your own place. So we went up the Totonic River line in our canoe and just explored up in the mountains a little bit and fished for some grayling and came back down. And Dick was he was talking with John McPhee. He had come out there and met Dick, and so we got to meet John McPhee at that point. That was 1976 in the summer. And we didn't know what we were going to do at that point. And we just didn't have it all planned out. So we went back to Eagle. We lined our canoe back to Eagle. And went out on a fire. BLM, I think, was fighting a fire up Eagle Creek. At the time, it was actually in Canada, but there was an agreement that we would fight that fire. And we just got hired on and went out there. And during that period, again, we didn't know what the hell we were going to do. And so I got to know Mike Potts at that point, and he invited me to go into the 40 mile and kind of help him finish up a cabin and watch meat while he went back to Eagle in the after the fall. And then he would train me how to do trapping and taking care of meat and other things like that. He had been living out in the village for a while. He had married Adeline Junipe, and so I decided to go with him kind of as an apprentice. And Charles went mining down near Chicken with some folks. And so we parted ways at that point. And so Mike really did a good job teaching me how to take care of meat. And we went hunting for a moose down on the North Fork of the 40 mile. That was about a 40 mile walk in from the road. And we had walked on the high country going over Minnecup in Oregon and down near Glacier Mountain and then down Clifford, down towards, I believe it was Clifford Creek. Forget the name of the streams that we were going in there. But we got a moose down on the North Fork of the 40 mile, and then we went up, we were going to hunt caribou up on Oregon or Glacier Mountain, caribou or sheep. Mm-hmm. And we ended up running into a grizzly sow with three big cubs that charged us, and we ended up having to shoot her, and the cubs left. And so that was the end of our hunt up in the Sheep Mountains, or the Caribou Mountains. So, but we packed that meat back down to the cabin. It was about a 15-mile pack, and we did it in stages. It was a big bear. And then he left, and so I was taking care of it. The next year, I went with this guy, John Gaudio. We were going to head down the Yukon River and find a place for us. We were thinking the Colleen River, go down and then up the Porcupine, the Colleen. Well, it turns out, you know, we stopped by Charlie Edwards, who lived at Shade Creek at the time, Charlie and Cher. There was Jan and Seymour, who lived down near the Candic River, across from Glen Creek. They were there because Jan was having a baby. So this is the spring of 1977, they needed meat. They had all of their dogs and all of Charlie and Cher's dogs and several people. And Charlie said he had just gotten a sheep up on near Fart Creek Bluff. So up on the hill, there's the limestone hogbacks that were, they were towards Hilliard. And then a little beyond that, there was a big series of bluffs just a little downstream from Fart Creek. And he had gone up there, and there were sheep up there. And he had shot one and wanted help packing it down. And so we went over there in his canoe and walked up on top of the mountain. And there was another sheep up there. And so he shot that one too. So there were two of these. They were young rams, and walked them back.
Where? On here, I guess I'm a little unclear.
Yeah, the F.
So you know where Fart Creek is, right?
No.
Could you spell that?
F A R T.
That's what everybody called it. It's this stream that comes out kind of downstream from Calico Bluff.
Okay.
And downstream of Pickerel Slough, right around that big corner before the long straight stretch to the 70-mile, and there's it's got some sort of a sulfur deposit in there because it comes out with yellow overflow
every
year. Okay. And if the wind is drifting down, it comes out into the river and it smells like rotten eggs. Okay. So everybody calls it Fart Creek.
Funny.
Yeah. Oh. And so that was, I mean, I wasn't hunting it, but we packed that sheep out, but we got to eat sheep that spring.
So that's a good segue. Wait, and you can ask questions too, Matt.
Was that this area?
So,
because here's
Calico Bluff is here. I have a hard time seeing where the river goes. Is that right there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's the limestone. Hogback.
Mm-hmm.
Just downstream from the limestone hogback, there's this big cliffy area that comes drains down to the Yukon.
Got it.
And it was up on that. It wasn't the hogback, but it was just to the west of the hogback. What do they call it?
And that's, they were just there, just above
Adams Peak.
The river.
They were actually way up,
like 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet. Up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but they were up there, and there's sheep all over the limestone hogbacks too, and over on Hilliard, the backside of Hilliard and the backside of the limestone hogbacks are just these giant cliffs that drop down to the Tatonda River, and one of the issues with it is that it's all forested on that side of that exposure. So it's these big cliffs and forests all the way to the top on the backside. On the north facing side. And the limestone hogbacks, though, there's trails, there's beds, there's all sorts of different activity up there from the sheep. They use that a lot. And as well as Hilliard, the backside of Hilliard is that way. And And so, I mean, a lot of people, there was a big burn there in the 60s that went over that whole region by the limestone hogback. So there's all these big dead trees all over the place that have fallen down. And so it's a very challenging place to go.
Yeah.
And so, there's only a few people I know that have gone up there to hunt sheep.
So Randy, but we're gonna segue now.
Okay.
That was a very good introduction of how you got your taste of sheep meat and mm-hmm. you were helping other hunters. And so what year did you start hunting sheep in what is now Yukon Charlie?
It was that year.
It was 1977. Okay.
So,
and do you remember what that first sheep hunt was like for you? And we'll let Matt chime in too. But do you remember that first experience?
It was with Dick Cook.
Okay.
And we went down stream from there and met Dick Cook at the mouth of the Totonac River. And he said, we should go hunt sheep. And so we went up the Totonac River to, there's a rock that has a name called Red. And then beyond Red, there's a pass that goes down. So from the Totonac River, you can walk over into Funnel Creek over this pass. And then it goes up high again in a big bluff down near the mouth of Funnel Creek that meets the mountains right behind the limestone hogbacks that comes down on that side. And so Funnel Creek comes out in there in a kind of a canyon in the Totonac. But downstream from there, and it's a really tough stream to walk up. It's just this narrow, heavily forested valley for about 3 miles to get up to where you can reach really easily going over this little pass between Totonac and Funnel Creek. And from that point, then you can walk right up Funnel Creek into that big amphitheater between Nimrod and what used to be Squaw Peak. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place, and a lot of open country in there, and a lot of sheep occupy that area. I mean, they're not always there. They can be over the top of the hill, or they can be over in Pass Creek or off at Hiu, that other mountain that connects on the other side of Nimrod. But we went up there and went hunting up in the towards Nimrod, towards the pass, going up to Nimrod,
what time of year was it?
It was June,
okay.
Early June, and
good weather.
It was beautiful weather, and
would you go up looking for rams in June, or did it matter?
Always, because they were bigger and they didn't have young, and
yep.
So they were the choice. I mean, that was, you know, back in those days, it was people fed themselves on the meat they got, and so there was there wasn't too much concern with, you know, seasons. There really wasn't law enforcement patrolling the area. We had hardly any hunters that would come in during that period, even during the season. And it was a different time, but that was my initiation to it. And they were lean then. They didn't have fat on them, but they were still very, very good meat. So the August, you know, that's after that experience, it was always August because, or September, but they were in such good condition. They were always fat.
That time of the year.
And in August, yeah. September.
And the nice thing, I'm wondering too, is like, you know, a moose, if you shot a moose in September, or I mean in June, that's a lot of meat.
They're totally skinny too.
Right. But in a sheep in June, that's not as much meat, and so it's not, you wouldn't be losing much. Like you wouldn't be wasting much because you'd be able to
you don't
go through it.
No, it's a it's the size of an animal that three people can eat in a week.
Wow.
And when you're eating just meat.
Yeah.
And that's what we were doing at that time. And so, no, it's a totally, totally doable piece of meat.
How
it'll
is
keep that long.
The all meat diet, you know, when you're just eating meat for a week straight, how do you feel? Like,
Great.
Okay. I've never had an all meat diet.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, how do you get all your vitamins? How do you get this? You know, you can't live on just meat. It's like, I don't know, people have been doing it for an awful long time.
Yeah.
And we did it, and it was fine. The challenge is having the fat to go with it. And because lean meat, you'll be always hungry, always very hungry, and you'll lose ground. But fat meat is... it's good. It's a whole diet, as far as I'm concerned. And I lived out there eating just meat for 4 years, so it was didn't bother me a bit.
Wow. And did you add other veggie? You know, local, like, you know, okay, berries maybe, but
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, but were there other, like, you know greens that you were able to?
Yeah, a little bit of greens, mostly berries, rose hips. You know, low bush cranberries in the fall,
yeah,
blueberries in August,
yeah, you know,
and sometimes in July, cloudberries. Those were always really good. No, there was, and we ate mushrooms at times. There was a big boletus, and then there were coral mushrooms and puff balls at the right stage. You know, they were good too. But it was, and you know, if we would go to visit other people that had other foods, we didn't have any problem eating bread or rice or other things like that.
Yeah.
But potatoes. But I didn't have them. And so when I was out cruising the country, it was, you know, they could be dry meat, it could be beavers were always had fat, so, and they were perfect food for traveling on the rivers. They were always there.
Would you just plink them?
Yeah.
Come and then just cook them up.
Yeah.
Or make fire or.
Yeah. No. They skin them out, take care of them just like any other meat, and there was fat and, you know, in a frying pan, and they're wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, and then it provides that food for your dogs as well.
Yeah.
And we had fish nets.
Yeah.
And fishing gear. So depending on where you were, you know, it might be some whitefish, you know, that you catch on a slough off the Yukon, or some pike or grayling in the slough off a Clearwater stream. And so it was one thing and another. We knew where, you know, all the lakes that had muskrats were, so they were good food as well.
Yeah.
Black bears, you know, in August or September were always good.
Yeah.
And a small enough piece of meat that you could take it in August and feed yourselves and your dogs and you know, before it goes bad.
Yeah.
Bear meat does not keep anywhere near as good as the ungulates, you know, sheep or caribou or moose, but it was very good.
I'll just one more question in this, because I find this really interesting, that you know, I'm trying to imagine, you okay, we're going to take off for a few days, I'll bring some meat with me, but the plan is to, like, acquire food as you go.
Always.
Did you ever kind of be like, I'm kind of not able to find food right now and getting kind of hungry, and, you know, were there moments where, you know, you didn't come into a beaver, or, you know, you couldn't catch a fish, or, like, where you didn't maybe eat for a few days, or what?
Yeah.
Okay, that happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you were, and that was, you're used to it. It was okay. You didn't get worried. Jeez.
No, we weren't worried.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always, yeah, we got the dogs, if it comes to that.
Okay.
You know, so, we never had to do that, but it was always there in the background.
Okay.
But it was we were pretty good at doing, we got pretty good at doing what we, yeah, what we did, you know. We could take a 22 and walk through a big spruce grove and shoot enough squirrels for the dogs to eat.
Yeah.
You know, and so we could, almost always you could put a gill net out and catch some fish. Very few cases that that didn't work. There have been some floodwaters in the Kandik River when I were going up the Kandik, when you couldn't find a beaver, and if you did shoot one, you probably couldn't catch, you know, it would,
yeah,
go downstream. We did figure out how to tell before you shoot a beaver whether they're going to float or not, and it was just because it was a crapshoot to start with, you know. We shoot one and it would sink, and you know, you'd dive down to get it, or you could see it on the bottom and hook it with a fishing line and get it, or it was hard, you know, we'd lose a few. And then we realized that what it was, because we had all these theories that, well, if they're really fat, or if they have just taken a breath before you,
yeah,
pop,
yeah,
you know, it's like none of that makes any difference. They got these little tiny lungs to them, they're little tiny miniature lungs, and has nothing to do with whether they float or not. What does have something to do with it is their stage of digestion, and they've got this big diverticulum part of their gut, and it fills up with air at certain times in their diet, in their digestive process, and they will float. And so when you see them swimming, the head is out and a good bit of the back is out, and they're going slow, because they can do that if they're motoring really fast, you know, to, you know, even when they'll sink. But if they're kind of moseying around and their back is out of the water, they're going to float.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter whether they're breathing right before you shoot or not, you know, or how fat they are. They're going to float. And so that makes it so that in a place where you might not be able to get them if they sunk, you could just choose not to pop them.
Yeah. Oh, that's...
yeah.
Talk about trial and error and just observing, yeah, and talking and just having that space and time to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Because when we would dive down and pick them off the bottom, you know, when we could do that, you know, so there was a sinker, they'd never had air in their guts.
Yeah.
Never. And so that was what it was, and once we figured that out, it became a lot more, yeah, of a certain thing.
And were you always skinning them and keeping the fur? No matter the season, did it matter?
No, we, you know, in summer they were they don't have really an underfur to them. Yeah. You know, they're not, you're not going to make anything out of them. You might take them as a seat cushion or something, you know, or you know, most of the cabins that we built back then just had dirt floors, so you could take a hide and just throw it on the floor and,
yeah,
just sort of have something to walk around on that you could then feed to the dogs when it, you know, got, you know, we dry them.
Yeah.
We would bend these birch circles and we would lash them.
Yeah.
Out to the edges, and it took a little while, but it was a nice round piece of fur that you could just, you know, sit on some, you know, a bunk made out of poles, you know, you could lay a few on that and it would round the edges off, you know. And so we used them, but,
okay,
but they were, you didn't make clothes out of them or a hat or mittens or anything. So they were more dog food and just temporary pads.
Yeah. Cool.
So going back to that first sheep hunt with Dick Cook,
yeah,
I'm assuming you guys were processing that meat and you weren't bringing it all out. You guys were eating it.
We ate it up.
Yep.
Yeah, we walked up to that pass, just about to the pass in Funnel Creek, you know, between what used to be Squaw and Peak and Nimrod, you know, just shy of it, because there was wood and there was water there. On the pass, there isn't any wood or water. And so we would go up hiking, you know, somebody would hike one direction, somebody another direction. We'd see sheep on the hills over at Hiyu. That's a hard place to get to, though. And, you know, we would spread out and go hunting. And we ended up getting a big ram right up beside the edge of Nimrod and brought him down. And so we ate that for a few days right there and explored around different caves that were full of sheep poop. And it was really fun just exploring.
You know, when you're on these sheep hunts, like, and what I'm hearing is, you know, you get your food and that gives you time to be in that space.
Gives you time.
And then you got time to go explore. You don't have to worry about food. You can just...
Yeah.
And you don't have any drawing you in another direction because you got what you need for that time.
Yeah, and so you get to learn the country.
Yeah.
You know, because if you can't get meat up there, then you got to haul it up there. And while you can haul a beaver, you know, be work, but you're not going to be able to stay there for more than a couple of days eating a beaver.
Yeah.
And then the dogs will be hungry. You know what I mean? There's everything about it. So, yeah you need the meat. And you hang it on these poles and put a tarp over it so it's not getting direct sun and it's not getting rain. It's getting air. And it'll last for a week or 10 days,
yeah.
No problem. And if you get something that's a little bit off, you throw it to the dog.
Yeah. How many dogs in this group?
Well, I had two, and Little John had three, and Dick had, I don't know, he must have three or four.
Okay. Oh,
he had
okay.
These great big gentle huskies there. They were wonderful. Yeah, so we had a fair entourage.
Yeah. So there's a lot of mouths to feed on that trip.
Yeah, and I mean, we had some dry fish, because Dick had fished chum salmon the year before, you know.
Yeah.
And so the dogs had packed a bunch of that up there, too. So they had, you know, anything we couldn't eat off of the sheep, they would eat. But they also had dry chum salmon.
Yeah.
So
that first sheep hunt, that was just the beginning of the...
Going
out sheep hunting every year after that.
Well, yeah. No, not really. But we would try to get up there as much as we could. And Little John and I, when we ended up going up the Kandig River, we met a few different people. Elizabeth and Mike Sager down Trout Creek. We saw Dave Evans, Page, Sage Patton down at Nation. We saw... Errol, who was over at Washington Creek, and then got down to the Kandig. And everybody was saying, hey, Fred lives at the mouth of the Kandig, but there's nobody up the river. And he is very ambitious about going very far. And so we decided, let's go and take a look. And so we ended up lining all the way 60 miles up the Kandig. And what we do is we had one canoe, and we had five dogs, because he had three, I had two. We would, one person would line the canoe, the other would walk all the spruce groves to find cabins, because we were trying to figure out, are there usable cabins up here at all?
Oh, okay.
And we came across a few old cabins, only one that was recent, and apparently John Chandelmeyer had gone out with somebody from Central. I think it was Ed Galvin had flown him and a buddy out to a place about 20 miles up the Kandig, and they had just put together this. It was a really kind of a lousy cabin, but it was just these trees on this bank with fiberglass in between, and a flat roof, and that you couldn't stand up in, and the table was a stump in the middle of the room with a piece of plywood nailed to it. So I was like, okay, well, this is pretty rudimentary, but it would be a good thing to have available if somebody needed it traveling along the river. So we ended up fixing that place up too. But we found a few, most of the cabins were not usable, and in fact, none except for that one were usable in the upper river. They had been built back 1930s, early 40s, before everything shut down for the war effort, and then everybody left. And so that was the age of the cabins that were up there, and some things were carved in them, like Evelyn, Bill, and Dickie. You know, Evelyn Berglund Shore, you know, she married Bill Grinnell. He went down to Fort Yukon, and they got married and came up to the Kandig River, and they had three cabins there, and little cabins, about as big as this table, you know, about 10 by 10 or thereabouts. And they lived there for a while, and then they had moved to Beaver Creek. But their cabins eventually caved in. They get a leak there where the stovepipe went through, and then the wall would collapse in and the roof. Anyway, it was that was just they didn't have plastic or metal or anything else to really do anything. It was all like tar paper.
Wow.
Just laid on top of the poles,
poles
and dirt on top of that.
Yeah.
But anyway, one of the things that was around every one of these cabins is giant piles of caribou antlers and moose antlers from the longevity of the people that had worked out of there and fed themselves off of the land there. And we thought, oh, this is a good place. We don't need to go to the choline.
Yeah.
And so that's where we ended up staying. Well, it's a long ways up the Kandig River till you get into sheep country. And they're there. We've walked over the Steppe Mountains, and they have sheep trails and sheep poop on them. So the Steppe Mountains are between the Kandig and the Nation. Yeah. And they have sheep trails on them. The Union and Indian Grave peaks, they have sheep trails on them. So it's there, but there are long ways to get to. And I've never seen sheep on either of those.
Oh, you haven't? You've just seen sheep trails?
Yeah, sheep trails and sheep poop and stuff. So,
okay.
So I know it's, you know, there's caribou that go all through that country too, or they used to. But they have very different poop and trails and everything else too.
So but you would travel between there. What, did you, you guys had a route between Nation and the Kandig, right?
Yeah, on that southwest side of the Steppe Mountains, mm-hmm. there was a pathway. And Dave and Sage, they would go from the Nation up over to the Kandig to a place that we called Middle Manor. It was a little cabin, beautiful cabin, on this big bedrock thing on the Kandig River, about almost 40 miles up the Kandig. And it ended up getting destroyed in a big breakup a few years ago. It just got just crushed against the, it had to be a hell of a breakup. We thought it was going to last forever.
So this is about 40 miles? Is that what you're saying?
Up, well, I can't even see where we are on this, but there's this big mountain right in here, and there's a
right off the river?
Yeah. And there's a little stream. We called it I forget what the name of the stream was, but there's a little stream that comes off of the southwest side of the Steppe Mountains that flows down to the Kandig River right near the bottom of this thing, and it's on a big bend in the Kandig, and that's where we had that cabin. Well, four of us went and built it. That had to be 79, maybe, summer 79. Dave wanted a cabin there. I wanted a cabin there. And Brad Snow came up and he took part in building. And Larry Ricketts, who at that point, Larry Ricketts came along. It had to be 79. But anyway, that was it. That was just, it was a travel cabin. You know, it was I think 10 by 10.
Shelter.
Shelter cabin, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was just a well-built.
Is it still standing?
No, it got crushed.
Oh, that's the one that got crushed. And it was off, it was on the Kandig.
It was on the Kandig.
Okay.
There was a big bend in the river with a big bedrock thing with a nice little grove of trees, which we used a fair number of to build the cabin. And, but it, there had to have been a breakup that kind of jammed, and it must have built up, but it pushed it back, and it's sort of off kilter, and logs disjoint and everything. So.
And then your cabin's further upriver.
There was a Indian Grave Creek, near the mouth of Indian Grave Creek, was one of them, and then the other one was just upstream of the park border by about a mile.
Oh, okay. Where'd you raise your kids at?
This one.
That one.
Yeah. I mean, we had both cabins. We would go up there to hunt caribou and to trap marten, and down here as well.
Okay.
But there were always more caribou in the upper.
Okay.
Upper place.
Hmm.
So
we would be looking for sheep up here, but I didn't ever find any. I walked this ridge here, you know, as well, and it has sheep sign on it at times. You know, the Cathool, the bottom end is Cathool, and then it goes up around the corner for a ways.
So because you were living in this area off the Kandik, you were searching areas closer for sheep, and you were seeing sheep sign.
But did you hit
a hot spot at some point?
I would make trips to Eagle every year.
Oh, I see.
And if I had time, I would go up into the Teutonic Mountains. And I have also gone back into Glacier Mountain. And exactly where it is on this map, maybe this done. So this is Oregon. So Glacier is right over here.
Okay.
Yeah. They call it Walcott.
So you
called it Oregon.
You'd make these trips into Eagle. Was there a time of the year you'd make them in?
Usually August.
August. Okay, and that was
sometimes June.
Was that to resupply?
So I would mush into town to send fur off to the fur auctions,
mm-hmm.
either Seattle or Vancouver, and that was in the be March, probably. Or sometimes early April, and send that away, and then I would come back to get the check at some point. You know, sometimes it was June,
okay.
Sometimes it was August, and get some sort of supplies. You know, whether it would be stovepipe or, you know, a new tarp or something like that,
mm-hmm.
rubber boots. They had a pretty good hardware store there.
So then on the way back home during these trips.
Yeah, then I would take off.
If you had chance, you'd stop and just go. And that was that more like, I'll go get a sheep and then I get some time to explore the mountains, be up here?
Well, it's like I didn't have anything I had to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I needed to be up the Kandik River in, you know, when moose hunting, you know, in the fall, in September.
Yeah.
No. And because that's when they're fat, and that's when we would get most of our fat for the year. Because a big bull gotten in, you know, the first half of September, we would sometimes render 12 gallons of oil off of them.
Wow.
12 gallons of rendered fat, and it keeps. You can pour it into a 5-gallon bucket. You know, you could got it decanted so you don't get a bunch of impurities in it. But after it boils up, you know, one big Dutch oven after another, you pour it through a screen and let all the stuff settle. You know, because it's nice, clear, little bit orange, and then it'll keep for 2 years or 3 years without going rancid.
You just keep it in the bucket.
Yeah.
And you just pull, scoop.
Well, it's hard. It's brittle.
It can brittle. Okay.
And so you jam a knife in there, pop a chunk off, and throw it in a pan. And then, you know, in the summertime when you might have, you know, some lean meat, you got the fat.
Yeah.
Because initially, the first summer out there, I had a 5-gallon can of fat that was rendered for dog food.
Yeah.
Out of those metal buckets. And that was, you know, I think back on it, you know, well, I needed it then, but I didn't want to eat that. I wanted to eat moose fat.
Yeah.
You know, or bear fat. But bear fat goes rancid. It won't keep over the summer.
Okay.
And same with beaver fat. You can't keep it over the summer.
How about caribou?
Caribou you can.
Yeah.
Caribou and moose both are really hard when they cool.
But sheep wasn't, that wasn't the goal.
It wasn't the goal. It was just go up and
be in the mountains.
Be in the mountains and enjoy the freedom that having a sheep gives you to explore.
Yeah.
And I had boundless energy at those times, and so you could walk all over the place.
Yeah.
And the dogs would carry packs, Yeah. You know, so you could take gear for a couple of days and walk across a valley and up some other mountain, and Cathedral Creek is flowing out towards the Nation River, just on the backside of Nimrod, you know, right near the border. And that's absolutely wonderful down in there too. And there's sheep all over in that country as well. But it's spectacular country to go exploring in.
Yeah. So
that was what it was an adventure.
Yeah.
That's really what it was.
And I really like that, because I think about it now as, you know, sheep hunting a lot is go to the mountains, you get your sheep, and then you got to go home. You know, and that, you know, you get the thing you went for, and then the trip's over. And this is like the reverse. You had to get the sheep to continue the trip.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's like a really exciting mentality and idea that, you know, it gave you this extra time to be in this country. And and why wouldn't you want to? Because it was like you spent all this time, you know, like moose hunting sounds to me more like you needed the moose, you had to get this moose, right? And this was the work to like survive throughout the winter. And it was like, but it's also in like challenging country and, you know, like a lot of bugs. And I'm just kind of like relating my experiences where sheep is like, you're up in the mountains and the alpine and this beautiful like terrain. And,
and you
just like want it to last forever, but it can't, because usually you're limited on how much support you have, like food or whatever. But when you get that sheep, now you got all this extra time.
And you said, you weren't in any rush to head back.
No.
You had that leisure time.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And you know, in August, king salmon had all gone past, and it was, you know, they're great. You wouldn't want to miss that. I mean, now it's such low levels, you know, it's shut down. But back then, we never got shut down. It may be that somebody was going to or pronounced it, but we didn't ever know about it.
And did you, for the Chinook, did you go down to the Yukon to catch them, or could you weren't catching them up the Canada Creek?
No, there were occasional Chinook salmon would be up there, but we never saw any sort of numbers. I think the most I saw at one time was 3 in a just a clear pool as we were floating over. You know, and they moved out of the way. But then, you know, you might go the whole trip with your dogs running the beach, and they might come across, you know, one in August laying on a beach, you know, that's ravens have been eating on or something.
Okay.
But it was there wasn't a run of them as you would think of it.
Okay.
There may have been a handful that spawned up there.
So timeline, you know, I guess I'm hearing you go down to Eagle in the summer to collect your check, and then on the way back, were you judicious about your trips down to the Yukon and back? Like, did you go collect your check in June, come back to your cabin, and then in August head down to go get salmon, and then come back? Like, how did that go down, I guess?
Since I went up the Kandik River in the fall to hunt moose, and I had my canoe with me, and so I only spent one spring up the Kandik River, and there's no birds that go through.
No waterfall.
There's no big south-facing bluffs that bears are going to hang out on.
Yeah.
It's a very rough place to make a living at in the spring.
Okay.
And so I would always go down to the mouth of the Kandik River, and you know, because there were the big lakes between the Kandik and you know, and the on the flats beside the mouths of it, both on the south side and the west side and the east side. And so they would, and then there were these open leads along the Yukon that would form, and then the sloughs around there, so you'd get geese coming in early and some of the some of the dabbler ducks coming in early to hang out around those open leads until the lakes open up along the edges, and you'll get a bunch of dabblers, you know, just hanging out in those places. And then there were, on, you know, on the big open south-facing hills of Cathell Mountain, there would be bears wandering all over the place. Sometimes you'd see three or four of them at a time, maybe a grizzly over there and a couple of black bears over here, sow with cubs over there, you know, and you'd be across the river, across the Yukon, and watching this with the scope, trying to figure out, okay, which one can I get, you know, is there a way to approach this one or that one, you know, and be able to figure out where you are as you're trying to walk up out of their scent, you know, and when do you go around, you know, you pick out vantage points, trees or rock outcroppings, that if we go up this gully, you know, then we can move across over to there, try to keep the dogs quiet on the other side of the river while we try to go across. Anyway, it was always a great adventure. But there was a lot of food to be had down there. And then when the lakes opened in May, you know, where they were totally open, you get these big rafts of scoters, you know, white-winged scoters and surf scoters and long-tailed ducks. And it was just this cacophony of just racket. You know, they were so wonderful to be in that situation, you know, where this big migration is going through. Because hardly any of them nest there. Like Davis, mm-hmm. are going through. But they come through kind of mid-May when the, you know, once the lakes open up.
When would you dog team down to the mouth?
Yeah.
In late.
So
late
I need to
spring.
Get my canoe.
To what?
I need to go get my canoe. So what I would do is after that, you know, mid-May time, I would walk over the mouth. I would go upstream from the mouth of Kandik towards Glen Creek, and then walk straight up that hill and walk the ridges over to the Kandik. It was about a 17-mile walk, and drop down right near, it's a mile and a half down from our
right
place.
Here, these ridges. Yeah. And then,
yeah,
or maybe here.
Well, there's a stream that comes down here. We used to mush up that stream. We called it Other Creek.
Was it upstream or downstream of the Big Horseshoe?
It's upstream of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just the border of the park is just upstream from that creek.
I think it's this one. Is it? And that stream goes way on, like.
Yeah, there's connects. Wolf Creek on this side, and
that's a nice pass.
We called it Other Creek. Yeah, it's a pretty steep one for going from this side up the other way.
So you would hike up this mountain and just walk.
We would walk and drop down right at the mouth of that stream.
Oh, that was a handy way to do it.
Yeah.
It was a great way.
It was.
Cut down a lot of travel.
It's beautiful high country up there. And there were sheep sign at times, but we never ran into them. I think it's rare. But I think, so there were a lot of other places we saw sheep along the river, you know, because downstream of the mouth of the 70-mile, for example, there's a big shale bluff on the south side of the Yukon. There have been sheep up there. And I used to hunt up the, when Karen was teaching in Eagle, I would go down and hunt up the 70-mile river. And at the narrow place, the 70-mile, you know, it goes up one way and then makes it almost a 180-degree turn. And in that narrow place, there were almost every year there's sheep sign there. And they're right down on their sandbars.
Real close.
Yeah.
Marcy, is it okay if I mark this up a little bit?
Yeah.
And, I mean, we never ran into them. But I think that was, they had to be coming from Glacier Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would sometimes get onto that big bluff just downstream of the 70 mile. It must be this one right here. And we've seen them there in the winter as well as the summer. So I don't know what they do. They you know, we would think, well, they're going to be afraid of wolves, so they've got to stay up in that high country. I don't think that's the case at all. Yeah. They do whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
And they deal with the threat when they see it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they've been on Calico before. They've been on Eagle Bluff before. Mm-hmm. I went downstream with Karen one time, and they were down on the bank on the north side, across from Eagle Bluff and downriver a couple of miles,
yeah,
you know, before you get to any of the streams down there. And that's, it's all flats.
Yeah.
But they're there.
Yeah.
So I don't know, they go all over the place.
Yeah.
I never did go up Sorensen or Twin Mountain, but some people did that were lived along the river.
Do you know of people that would go up the Charlie? I mean, you got to go a long ways up until...
Yeah, it's about 40 miles.
Right, and at some point, I don't know if... I guess... I know it gets, you know, you can't just go up on a jet boat, right? Like, there's...
I don't know, but none of us had jet boats.
Nobody had jet boats. Yeah, yeah.
That was a financial decision that none of us could make.
A limitation.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, were there people lining canoes up, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, in that country?
Yeah, but it was a little bit of a, it was not near as desirable as the Teutonic Mountains or Glacier, yeah, Mountain, because there were a huge number of hunters would go in there.
Okay.
They would fly in and they would boat up with jet boats. And so there was much more of a public interface, of people from town, mm-hmm, that would go in over there on Twin and Sorensen. It was just a different kind of a place.
Yeah. Okay.
And a lot of times, you know, there's angst between, you know, the river people and the the trophy hunter,
mm-hmm,
types, and there was no getting around that. So it was kind of uncomfortable.
You guys kind of had to find the spaces that,
yeah,
that you could fit into, feels like, you know. And
there was that, yeah. Yeah.
So,
there was that.
So Randy, we have a unique situation here where you were hunting when you first arrived in the country, and then now when did you move to Fairbanks? And then we're trying to... We have a good chance here to do a comparison when you were hunting sheep, when you were living out there, and then now you're going back into the preserve and looking for sheep, and are you hitting some of those same spots? And so we're going to try and do a compare and contrast type of interview. So you left...
In 91.
Okay, that's right.
I came to Fairbanks, and our kids were just about 4 and just about 8. When we moved in there, and I started going back to college, and I would go up onto the Yukon usually through Circle, sometimes through Eagle up the 70 mile to hunt moose in the fall. And then when my older boy Jed got big enough and wanted to go hunting for sheep, we started going out hunting sheep. We would go up into Teutonic Mountains and hunt sheep up there. We've been there, I think, 3 different times. And then we went up into Glacier Mountain one time.
Okay.
And
so you were going back to local spots that you were familiar with,
mm-hmm,
taking your son there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then my younger boy, he and his wife came up a couple of summers ago, and we were gonna either hunt caribou out on the ridge, you know, going towards Glacier Mountain and Oregon, or we were gonna go up on the limestone hogbacks. We didn't have time to go all the way up to Tonda, but we had time to climb up there and look for sheep there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unfortunate, but it was socked in, absolutely socked in from the first day we got up on top of the summit there. We went into past Minnicup and down into that alder patch just beyond Minnicup going towards Oregon, where there was wood there, you know, and there was water there, and that's been a camp spot I've used in the past. But it's, and there was caribou, there was fresh caribou sign there too, except we couldn't see 50 feet. It was raining and or drizzling and foggy. For 2 days we were out there and it was not clearing up. And we sat on certain places and, you know, you could see a trail, but it's 50 feet away.
Yeah.
You know? And so we finally decided, well, let's go and do something else, go fishing on the Yukon or something for pike. And maybe it'll clear off. And we had in mind that we might go up the limestone hogbacks at that time. And
so access was via, your access into those areas were via?
Well, so the going out on the ridge towards Oregon, it was just, we drove the truck up to the, to the pass, well, to the summit there.
And then you, in regards to the limestone areas, you were...
We went down by boat.
You were going by boat and then walking in.
Yeah, except, it's all clear except Hilliard and the limestone hogbacks. It's just totally socked in from about halfway down the mountain up. You know, we're going to like, okay, well, that's not going to work. And so it looked like it cleared up another day out of Eagle, and we went back up onto the summit, but the summit was all fogged in again still. So we didn't make it, but that's sometimes what happens in the mountains.
Yeah, so that actually leads to the next question, is what are some of the challenges that may hinder your ability to go sheep hunting every year?
Well, you know, part of it is that I have a life here, and
yeah.
So there's a travel, and then also I'm not in the same situation I was back in the 70s and 80s, where I don't have the leeway to go up into the mountains and just sit there and eat a sheep.
Yeah.
And I often take one dog with me, mm-hmm. and just kind of as a bear guard in camp, but it's different. And so I'm in the case where you were talking about, Matt, where you get it and you dry it, you know, hang it, dry it for a day, and then you're kind of on time because it's going to go bad in August, in, you know, 70, 80 degree temperature or whatever it gets there during the day, and or drizzly rain and stuff, and so. If you want to save it, you gotta walk it out, because it's a couple days to get out of those mountains. You know, you gotta walk it down and over to Totonic, and then paddle down Totonic. And, you know, some people get up the Totonic in jet boats, and it's a challenging river, though. There's ways to screw up doing that.
Yeah.
There's ways to screw up with a canoe too, but I've done a lot of canoeing on those rivers, and so I fancy that I can pick out those spots that are dangerous and pull aside, walk it down, or line it up, or whatever.
Yeah.
Rather than get into trouble.
But yeah.
So back then, what type of planning did you have to do in order to have a successful sheep hunt? And like, was there much planning? Because it doesn't sound like it. You basically could just go wander into the mountains and. You get a sheep, you get a sheep.
It was totally opportunistic.
And
floating down from Eagle, hey, those mountains look pretty nice. Shall we go up for a week or two? Yeah, let's go. We'd go.
Yeah. Versus now, where it does take quite a bit of planning because you're coming from town.
Oh, yeah.
And you're planning around other events.
Yeah.
And your job and other people's lives.
Yeah, and in contrast with, you know, the first year where we went out with Charlie Edwards and then with Dick, you know, we're only looking for a legal ram right now. It's not a sheep. It's a legal sheep.
Yeah.
And you know, and I suppose it should have been back then too, but it wasn't. That was not how people were doing things, and there wasn't. It was a difficult situation, you know, in order to be be legal out there too, because there was nobody in Eagle that sold licenses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't have a car, if you weren't going to Fairbanks, you didn't have a way to get one.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like there was a trooper one time and a BLM ranger that made a trip down, you know, a snow machine trip down the river to visit with people, and they offered to give licenses out to people that didn't have them. And even if you had a license, you can't get a hunting tag for it, you know, for a particular species. And I wrote a guy at a fishing game one time and says, how do we do this? He says, just do your best. Don't waste anything. And, you know, that was his comment because he didn't have an answer either.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, I don't know, we did our best. I mean, people didn't waste anything. They got what they needed. But when I was first out there, I had no idea what day it was. You know, it's not like, okay, you know, hunting season starts today, you know, or closes today.
Yeah.
Or I didn't have a calendar. Yeah. I just didn't have it, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe there were some people that did, but I think a lot of people were in that position. I didn't have a watch or a clock or anything either.
You guys were living you were choosing where you live because you were spacing yourself out so everyone had enough food.
Yeah.
Right? And so there was, it was already managed. You were managing harvest.
Yeah.
Locally.
There was almost nobody out there at the time from Fairbanks. You know, we might, you know, see one boat go downriver, you know, a big old wallowing river boat, you know, from somebody that was going to try to hunt moose along the Yukon, but there were no throngs of people out there back in the 70s. Sometime, I think as the 80s got along, it got to be more popular, but certainly not in the 70s. There was almost nobody there.
Yeah.
That whole stretch.
So now we're kind of going to do some questions about your observations over time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to some of the same spots that you used to go to when you were living out there, and then going to those same places now, have you noticed any changes in the sheep populations or the local populations?
No. I mean, it was always, you know, you couldn't necessarily count on there being, you know, a big herd of sheep here or a big herd of sheep there. It was always, you know, you'd walk up a valley, you'd be looking at different places, checking out for them, and if you didn't see them, you'd walk over into another valley. You know, it was always that sort of a thing. I know we've met quite a number of hunters up Totondic River in Funnel Creek and Pass Creek over the last, 15 years, you know, that I've gone up there. Five times maybe over that period of time, and we've run into people every time up there, and there's a guy from Anchorage that was up there, and they, all of the people except for me are up there with a jet boat. They run a jet boat up and park it somewhere, and then walk over into Funnel Creek and up somewhere, or park it down near the mouth of Pass Creek. But Pass Creek had a big burn in it. And down towards the mouth, these trees, it burned really deep into the soil, and these trees just slid right down into the valley bottom. It's a nasty place right now to get by. But farther up, it opens up. But it's a more difficult approach to the mountain because the mountain is forested up a ways, and there's all these dead, burned trees laying around on the side of the mountain. Side of, you know, that face of Nimrod and the ridge going over towards Hiyu, and that used to be just completely walkable forest, you know, back in the in the 70s and 80s, and not anymore, and so that limits how people get into there. But there was one guy from Anchorage, and he was bringing his two teenage kids along, and they were going up to the pass between Nimrod Sorry, I don't remember the new name for Suape.
Jejezu Trinja.
Jejezu Trinja. And they were camped right on that pass. And so we run into them there a few times. And my camp is, you know, the camp that I have used over the years is downstream from there. It's on Funnel Creek, so there's water, there's wood. And then I just walk up into the country that way.
Okay.
Either up on the pass, going over to Pass Creek, or, you know, and up onto the Nimrod Ridge, or up the valley, and, you know, looking up on the side hills. Sometimes up the ridge right behind where my camp is. It's a forested ridge all the way up to the top, and then you're into that big scree slope of the mountain up there, and all the different, you know, these limestone towers and sheep trails going through them. It's just a good place for to base out of, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And but these guys up on the pass, they want fennis sheep.
Mm.
And they are not going to, a full curl fennis sheep, and they want to make a full mount with it. And so I've seen them there several years running, and they never get anything because they're not going to shoot a white one. Mm. And I don't know. That's a pretty narrow order.
Yeah.
But full curl fennin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you bump into fennin sheeps in your time? Do you
always
remember?
Yeah.
Okay, you'd find these.
I've seen them all the way from straight brown to straight white. And a lot of them that have, you know, a kind of a saddle over the shoulders, you know, brown sides,
yeah.
Dark rump.
Yeah.
One time, my older boy and I were on the side of Nimrod with Funnel Creek down below, and the big scree slopes on the other side, and we saw this white sheep. And I don't take a telescope along. I just look, and I got a 3-9
yeah.
Leopold, you know, and I zoom in at 9, look over there. There's three sheep. There's a white one and two brown ones, all rams.
Yeah.
And we were too far away to know whether they're legal or not, but they look big, you know.
Yeah.
And this scree slope, you can see it running all the way across there. And then there's these gullies as you get towards the lower end of it. And we decided we're going to go straight down off of Nimrod and then straight up the other side and see if we can get there before the sheep get there.
Yeah.
And we didn't, but we got there just after them. And so we got up on, there's these rocky ridges, you know, and then there's these swales, and you can see the trail going on each one of them.
Yeah.
And we got up on this one, and there's the sheep, the white sheep, is on the next one over. And I always wondered how they get the brooming,
yeah,
on the horns, because they're really tough.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, okay, so a tip here and a tip there, and they're charging each other. Is that going to break it?
Yeah.
I don't see it. There's
yeah.
no.
Yeah.
They're just going to slip off of each
yeah.
other. This sheep is standing up by this limestone tower, and he's getting up on his back legs and bam, hitting this rock. He's about 300 yards away from us, straight across, and he's whacking this rock with his horns, practicing, right?
Yeah.
And he's doing it over and over. And I thought, that's how they break them. They break them because as soon as they get full curl,
yeah.
that's the first thing that hits,
yeah.
is the tips. So he's over there, bashing into this rock. And so we lined up and popped him. And down he went. And we're still looking for the brown ones. And so we run across on this trail. And yeah, because he had two broomed.
Yeah.
Tips, you know, and we ran across on this trail, and the two brown ones were just cresting this ridge between a couple of towers, but the sun was right behind them, and so we could see them, but we couldn't tell whether they were full curl or not, but it was like they're totally brown. So it was pretty neat. But what I've gotten sheep that have brown on them up there. Ones that have been all white, I don't care one
sure.
way or another.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm just going for food.
Yeah. Well, if they were all brown and there was a few white ones, people would be going for the white ones.
Yeah.
So, you know,
Well, so those Fannin sheep have been seen down in the northern wrangles, too. There was a fellow wrote a paper back in the 70s on seeing them down there up the Nebesna River. And then there's been, you know, some genetics papers showing that stone sheep and doll sheep are the same. They're the same species, and it's just color phases along the north-south gradient. So,
have you noticed any changes in the, now that you're targeting rams, bull curl rams, have you noticed any changes in the number of them when you go to these areas?
So there were a couple of folks that were camped on that pass between Funnel Creek and Pass Creek down the ridge from Nimrod, and they thought that that year we didn't get a sheep. It was the only time I've been up there where I did.
And what year was this? I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly. This was 2017, maybe.
Okay. All right.
And they thought they had seen a couple of other people up there, and then one guy, you know, that was skirting around on the, I don't know where he came from.
Sure.
But and so there may be people that fly in and get landed somewhere. There used to be a place afar on the Totonac River where a Super Cub could land. It looked really sketchy to me, and the bar isn't supportive of that anymore. But I don't know where everybody comes from, but the people that I've seen up there have all come by boat. And from up the Totonac, and then the walk-in, but these guys thought that that the number of people up here has depleted the rams, the legal rams. I don't buy that for a second. Huh. If you look at the old Ogilvies, this is just a tip off the edge of it, and it is just this mass as far as the eye can see of sheep country.
Yeah,
big, beautiful limestone mountains all the way back this way and all the way north, you know, going almost to the Porcupine. And it's this massive big mountain range that is full of sheep, and it's all inaccessible. I mean, I know there's a guy that had been, when we were out here, we knew there was a guy that was guiding with horses on the Canadian side. Yeah. And they would drive the horses in from the Dempster, I believe, and they operated out of Dawson. And they had two or three different cabins, one on the South Fork Totonac, one on a couple on the North Fork, I think. And they had airstrips that they would land people with. And then they would haul them around with horses, and they would be hunting all sorts of stuff, you know, but including sheep. But we've looked, you know, from up in the Totonac Mountains, we have looked out into that country and realized this is a massive population of sheep, and what we're seeing here is just the fringe.
Yep.
And so I think they move all over the place, and I don't think that, you know, the few people that ever get up there and get a sheep is depleting it at all.
So are you seeing ewes and lambs and
lots?
Okay. Have you noticed any changes in sheep behavior when you're out there spotting them?
No. Nothing in general, they're not really very afraid of people. You know, and which doesn't mean they're going to let you walk right up on them if they're watching you, but you know, they'll stand up on a ridge and watch you. They don't really, they're not running away or afraid of you or anything.
Yeah. And, planes flying over, or are they scared? No.
Okay. Well, I don't know about that. I haven't seen planes up there really, but I don't think that we're making a dent in it.
Did you ever, you know, did people ever come in from
The nation? Yeah.
It's a bit of a poke in there.
It's like a 10-mile walk across a black spruce tussock ridge. It's a very challenging place to go in. It gets into sheep country right away, though it's right on the border.
Yeah.
But it's a very, you're not going to pack it out.
Yeah.
Of course,
You weren't gonna. So was there ever any exploration? Did you guys ever? Was that like, oh, let's go check it out on the north end over here?
We did some exploring down across, the Hard Luck Creek,
yeah.
You know, comes up and takes turns around in there. We have accessed it. I have accessed it from the Totonac River, yeah. Though.
And you just kept moving north.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, because it's all sheep country, you know, and it's all mountains, and in the old days we didn't really pay that much attention to that line there.
That's what I was been wanting to ask.
No, well, that's how we knew there were horse trails all over up there as we went up. We went walking up there,
yep.
Into the North Fork of Totonac. South Fork is you don't get into a valley that you can wander around in for a long ways east. But the North Fork is a nice, U-shaped valley with sheep mountains on both sides and forested, and there's sheep trails all over. There were back then.
Wow.
I mean, not sheep trails. There were sheep trails all over, but there were
horse trails
yeah. All over the place. And so it was quite different, and there are people that go in there hunting, but it's such a big country,
yeah.
And the impact, I think, is so small by comparison to, say, the deltas or the Alaska Range or some of the Brooks Range places. I've been flying over the Marsh Fork in the Canning River and mm-hmm. seen people on, four or five different bluffs all at one time,
yep.
Big hillsides hunting sheep. Yeah. And so I think this the hunting pressure here is low. That would be my guess from seeing it at that time of the year.
But the opposite side, the Charlie is just is high enough where it kept subsistence users out. They had to work the margins a bit more.
And Glacier Mountain is just remote enough, and it's a non-motorized mm-hmm. Hunt. So somebody's got to walk 20 miles to get there, and not too many people do.
Yeah. And were there old mining trails back in the day to get up into that country?
Not really. The mining trails went from Eagle up the 70 mile and then up the Mission Creek and then over the 70 mile. There were some mines down in Teddy's Fork.
Mm-hmm.
And Teddy's Fork is where that that bunch of alders is on the, if you go out of Eagle to the pass, it's about 12, 13 miles out, then the Glacier Mountain Trail goes, and you get up onto Minicup, which is that first big rise there, and then it drops down into the headwaters of Teddy's Fork,
mm-hmm.
which is all these giant alders that used to be a disaster to get through. They're still not all that easy, but then it goes up onto the hill going towards Oregon, and then you're up above timberline. There's no wood. There is a place where there's water. There's one, though. And it's a clear shot all the way. It's beautiful walking, but it's up and down, and hauling a sheep out would be really challenging.
Yeah.
So this next question is kind of looking to see if you've had to adapt in any way when it comes to sheep hunting. Like, are there some challenges that expose themselves, and then have you had to modify anything, or is the style of sheep hunting you do still the same as you did back then? We talked about the lifestyle versus now living in town and going out and looking
mm-hmm.
for sheep, but anything else that comes to mind about newer challenges that you're having to adapt to?
Well, my eyesight is declining.
Oh, I didn't mean to.
Is that what you meant?
No, I guess you're not seeing a lot. You're not competing with a lot of outside hunters, it sounds like. Not as far as the local areas you go to. So that's not
it. It doesn't bother me even in the slightest.
Okay.
And I understand they're there. They're out there doing exactly the same thing I am. That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't care. I don't feel possessive or territorial or anything over any of it. And
was there a time that you did? No.
I never did.
Never did, yeah. So when Dick Cook said, no, time to move on, was that surprising, or was that...
You know, at the time, I'm going like, how about if we make sure we're at least a mile from your place? You know, we're thinking Santa Fe, right? And he's like, no. And as soon as I had spent a little time out there, I realized, oh yeah, that was absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
It came from a perspective that is so different, and this is it's a different place.
Yeah. And going back, if you could have done this in Santa Fe, let's say, do you think you could have lived a mile away? Was there such high game? Did you come from such a high game density area, or where that would have been possible, or was it just being you being green to kind of this lifestyle?
Yeah, totally green. Yeah. You know, it was. I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, it was really a good thing that I was able to connect with Mike Potts,
yeah,
and go out and really be an apprentice there, because there were some people that did come out into the woods, had no idea what they were doing, and they would build cabins that are totally non-functional. You know, they either, spike them together and put them up and then try to jam moss in, which doesn't work. It doesn't, it's not a way to, seal a cabin up. And, or they would build on this cut bank, with the river coming across, just because it's such a great view. And after all, it probably has been this way for 100 years, except no, it hasn't been that way for 100 years. And it won't stay that way for 10 years, And they get their cabins taken off the banks and things like that. So it was, and taking care of meat. There were people who didn't know how to take care of meat. They'd put it in a hole in the ground. It's like, no, don't do that. It's colder. I don't care. You need air.
Mm-hmm.
You need air on it. Yeah. And it's not going to keep there. It's going to spoil.
Yeah.
And so that, all of those things I learned with Mike. And Adeline, she sewed me my first pair of mittens and mukluks and hat. And I used those patterns, whenever they would wear out to, cut and sew my own clothes, when I started tanning skins and things. So it was hugely valuable to have that experience. So
being that sheep hunting season overlaps with moose and caribou hunting season, does this pose any challenges now that you're...
So I went up there one time, up to Totonic River. I was hunting with a buddy of mine, Scott McLean, who I've known for years. And we traveled up the Totonic River to that to where that pass goes over to Funnel Creek, and this is like September, September 10, something like that. Sheep season was still open, moose season was open, and we hadn't seen track one on the way up there. And we said, well, let's take a walk up in the sheep house. And he had a friend of his from Seattle along, and that guy didn't think he could walk over the pass and up Funnel Creek. So he stayed on the river, and we went up there and ended up getting a sheep. We went up and then climbed way up onto this one ridge so we could look around. We'd actually seen a couple of sheep up there, and we walked up there, and they had disappeared. And down in Funnel Creek, there was this group of four rams that were walking right down the river. And it's one of the cool things about it is it's steep enough, and it's all bedrock on the bottom. So, a rock will sometimes get pushed because it's the water's really traveling fast. And it'll clunk, 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 clunk. You can hear it from a long ways away. Mm-hmm. And these sheep were walking right on that bedrock. So it was all clack, 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 clack. So we could hear it from way up the side of the mountain. And so we, again, instead of being down, climbing up on those sheep that were going on that trail, we ran down the ridge and dropped down, thinking we were going to get ahead of them if they're walking right down the stream. And they didn't show up. So we started walking one of these little, limestone mm-hmm. gullies after another, going up, and we got right straight over the top of them. four rams. And we're like, we're looking at them, and there was enough noise from the stream that they had no idea we were there. But we're just like 50 feet over them. And they're all bedded down, right next to this big cliff. And we're trying to figure out, how do we tell if they're full curl or not? Because you're looking straight down on them rather than sideways.
Yeah.
And it was, we looked at them for a long time and we couldn't tell. And so I started throwing these rocks down. They totally ignore them.
Wow.
Totally ignore them.
Just used to rocks falling.
They're used to rocks falling.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're sitting there chewing and sitting there looking down on the stream. And finally one of the rocks landed a little close to one of them, and it got up and started walking. And that one had two brooms. And so Scott ended up taking that one. And the other three just stood 50 feet away.
He was the leader.
He had to be the leader. And they were not full curl. None of those three were. But they just sat there stood there and watched us. And so it started getting dark, which doesn't happen in August.
Yeah.
But started getting dark, and we said, well, we gotta head back. But we didn't bring pack frames to pack it out. So we just tied it on a pole, you know, so the meat was getting air, and started down to the creek. And this big full-out fan and ram, full curl fan and ram, comes walking right up the creek, sees us, we're 50 feet away or so, and he walks up on the other side, stands there sideways looking at us for a minute, and then goes into the trees. And we had decided we weren't going to take him, just because we were going to pack this one out, and we were hoping to get a moose. Well, we didn't get a moose that year, but it was, and so in retrospect, we were like, well, we should have taken him. But if we had taken him, we would have spent the night up there, and Scott's buddy was nervous about everything up there. Anyway, he came from Oregon or somewhere. But
if he'd have been nervous if you wouldn't have showed back up.
Oh, yeah, but he wouldn't have been able to do anything about it, but he'd have been scared.
Yeah.
And
still at the river.
Yeah, still on the river. And so we just walked back.
I don't know what it is about sheep hunting, but it's almost like you're not allowed to shoot them before, you know, 8 p.m., you know. Or, you know, it's like it just always happens at the end of the day, and it's always a late night pack out. It's my experience, at least, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But let me tell you, that September sheep, the fur was so much thicker than anything in August.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And all we saw, there were rams at that time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and their rut isn't until November.
Yeah.
So it's, they're going to be fat for a long time. But it was a very good eating ram there. So. Yeah.
Have you noticed any changes in the weather over the time period you tend to go hunting now?
Well,
or even back then?
I think it's always really variable.
Okay.
Up in those mountains. It was really funny, though, a little after Windfall Mountain started smoking like crazy, I went up there, when that was, it was 2015, maybe, 14, it was 2014. I went up there with my cousin and her boyfriend. She comes from down at Gustavus, and she had never been sheep hunting before, and so we were going to go up in the mountains and see what we could find there. And so we're motoring up in that, I got a 19-foot Grumman with a little 8-horse on it, and we're motoring up the river there, and it's kind of high water, and so I can motor up most of it. And we get beside Windfall, and Windfall is just pouring out smoke, and it's blowing like crazy, and there's a lightning storm on top of Nimrod, and we're like, you know, and thinking, though, this sounds like Middle Earth. You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's what I was
saying. Throw the ring. Yeah. Frodo. Anyway, yeah, it was pretty wild. So that was a wild scene.
Yeah.
So how do you process it? You just gut it out there, and then when you said you had it hanging from a pole and you guys were walking it out, what do you guys do to process it that way?
Well, so that was, you're talking about the September hunt?
Yeah, that one you did with your...
Yeah.
with the
well,
two other guys?
Well, we just went back there the next morning.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We walked back and got, we brought enough to eat, okay. You know, for a treat that night.
Yeah.
And then we went back and first thing the next morning.
Okay. Okay.
Has the way you've cleaned animals changed?
Not
since
really.
Not say yeah. Okay.
I've from the first time that Mike Potts showed me, demonstrated how to butcher animals, I've done it that way ever since.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you skin back one side, you take a shoulder, a back leg, the ribs, the belly, take the guts out, flip them over, do the other side. And I do that with sheep even. I mean, yeah. You don't need to with sheep, but it's the best, cleanest way to do it,
yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, Randy, we're going to close out with some questions that all kind of mesh together.
Mm-hmm.
But please share the importance of sheep and sheep hunting to you and your family.
Well, it is not a, you know, a fundamental aspect of like getting a winter supply of meat. Mm-hmm. And it never has been. It's much more of an adventure up in the mountains. A good excuse to get in the mountains and walk. It's you know, it's vigorous, it's spectacular. I guess you know, I like the country they're in, so it's much more of an adventure than it is, you know, for example, moose hunting fills the freezer, and sheep feeds the soul, I guess. Mm-hmm. If you will.
Yeah.
And that's how it is for me.
So that leads into what motivates you to go sheep hunting.
Yeah. And that's what it is, defeating the soul, you know, getting up in the mountains. I've never been one to climb mountains just to get to the top. You know, it's I mean, we did that a little bit when I was kids, and and my brothers, both of my brothers off of my family. There were three of us, and they both are mountain climbers and climb cliffs. Mm. And things like that, or have. I'm not sure how much they do it anymore. And my older son is a mountain climber, and he climbs cliffs and climbs, you know, big snow mountains and everything else. I go where there's sheep. I don't know. I like a purpose, and maybe that was what kind of spoiled me when I was living out here. Is that I like doing things when there's something to be had at the other end. You know, if I'm going to go, for example, snowshoeing, I want it to be for a purpose. I go snowshoeing into, you know, to pack a dog trail back into a place where I'm going to cut firewood or get big birches to make sled runners or bowls out of or something like that. You know, I don't do much just as recreation. You know, yet when I came to town, I never skied, Nordic skied at all out in the woods. It just wasn't functional. You know, I couldn't make a dog trail for it. The boots that they had back in the 70s, I never saw any that would keep your feet warm. And it was like, this doesn't make any sense for out here.
Yeah.
When I get to town and everybody's doing the Nordic skiing around Birch Hill and out on, you know, wherever trails they have around Fairbanks. I got some skis and my kids were into it at the time, or my older boy anyway, and so I started doing it, but it never clicked with me. Mm-hmm. Because I was doing it for exercise sake. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of exercise out in the woods, but it wasn't for exercise sake. And so I still try to keep busy with firewood or with, you know, sheep hunting or moose hunting or things like that, where I'm doing exercise, I'm working, staying in shape, but it isn't, you know, like going to a health club or going doing the same round over and over and over up at Birch Hill.
Yeah.
It just never clicked with me. And I used to enjoy downhill skiing. I don't do it anymore, but it was just plain fun.
Yeah.
You know, and Nordic skiing for me wasn't. So I don't know. I like a purpose. And so, you know, just climbing in the sheep mountains, if you didn't have something you wanted to do there, if you weren't looking for sheep, it might be a totally different thing. I mean, I don't, it's not, it's not going to make or break the trip whether we come back with a sheep or not, but it's always nice, and it's a, it gives a purpose to it. But
so what do you think is important to share about the land where you go sheep hunting? How important is this land to you, which is now a preserve in other land jurisdictions? But
I don't know, it's just it's been a real pivotal thing for me. You know, as a young man, and even now, I love it. I love getting up in those systems, you know, the rivers and the mountains, even dealing with brush and down trees and everything else. It's part of the landscape. And one thing, you know, I learned, and pretty much everybody that lived out there learned, is there's no easy way to go about some of this. You know, I mean, you may pick the right, you know, tree line going across the flats to be able to stay out of the big tussocks, but it's all going to take work to get out there. But it's really, you know, a campfire with driftwood along a river, being up in the mountains when a storm goes through, these are just wonderful, wonderful things. So I think it's just spectacular country. It, you know, it's not like, you know, going into Denali and going up on, you know, some of these, you know, big giant mountains. But it's still got its attraction.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to ask?
I think we covered it pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah. I've really enjoyed the stories and, you know, relating this, your subsistence, what sheep hunting was for your subsistence lifestyle. And, you know, it really kind of, I guess what hit home for me was that, you know, it was this, it was all part of, you know, subsistence just isn't eating, you know, it's being there too. And it allowed you to be there. And I just think that I hadn't thought of it in that way. So
yeah.
I think that's my takeaway from this. It's like really exciting. So relatable to today, you know, in ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Randy. We really appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome.
So back in 2000, it was the worst Chinook salmon run we've ever had until recently.
Yeah.
And in 2000. And the state, and it was the first year when federal co-management of the fishery was going to be happening. And the guy that was the federal manager was my boss from just upstairs. His name was Monty Millard. And they were doing the Yurt Vitale conference, and the state had opened up three different commercial fisheries. And in those days, the commercial fisheries would take 100,000 to 150,000 Chinook salmon in the Delta. And he had opened three fisheries, two in Y1 and one in Y2. Y1 is kind of like downstream from, you know, it's just the Delta region, downstream from...
It's that first section.
Yeah, that first section of the river. And then Y2 is the next section that goes out. I don't know how far up it goes, but like from the Andreevsky up a ways. Anyway, not to Holy Cross. But in that stretch of river. So he'd opened three, and he said on the Yurtma conference that this was Tom Fania that was the fish and game manager. And he was going to open a fourth commercial fishery in Y2, which was the second in Y2. And at this point, you know, none of the indices of abundance. They were doing test netting and they had pilot station, but it was high and there was driftwood, you know, and you got Andreevsky River, but it always gets late run. But nobody had a clue whether it was going to be a good run or not. And so Monty, on this teleconference there, where people up and down the river are all on this teleconference, he says to Tom Vanya that he's going to shut the fishery down until we get some quantitative information on how many fish there are coming in the river. And that generated, it was the first time a federal manager had been there to coordinate with the state. The state hated it. Tom Bonilla hated the idea of it. And so it caused this giant uproar that involved the Canadians and the governor, everything. They finally realized that it's a terrible run. And they shut down subsistence. Well, you can't shut down subsistence after you do a commercial fishery.
No.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, your priority is escapement, subsistence, and then commercial. And it goes exactly the opposite in practice, right?
Yeah.
But they'd already harvested 50 or 70,000 fish in that commercial fishery. And it turned out to be a good thing that they stopped. But Monty didn't know any better than they knew whether it was going to turn out to be a good run. It just always had been in the past. And so, anyway, it was shut down in the upper river. The whole subsistence was shut down. And Dick Cook, it's possible he never knew about it, because we didn't for a long time. And he didn't have a radio. He didn't, you know what was going on in the bigger world. And he was setting his net upstream from Totonac River. And it was, I believe it was a Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement saw it, flew flying by with a float plane, and went down and pulled his net out of the water, left him a note that it's closed season. Well, he gets back down, he sets it right back in the river. He was living up at Pass Creek, up to Totonac River at that time. And so the next day, the law enforcement guy came by again and pulled his net out, gave a citation to Dick for putting it in during close season, and took the fish out of it and the net and gave the fish to somebody else in some community. You know, I don't know where he did that with. Well, Dick was pissed because it's his position that you can't always make things even by shutting down subsistence.
Yeah.
And that Title 8 of ANILCA says, no, you have to, if there is a shortage, you have to set up like a tier 2 system, you know, where your priority individuals, you know, who have been, you know, live in the remote area and everything else. So he sued them with this lawyer here in town. What the hell's his name? I've got the legal case they sued. They were going to sue, I think Fish and Wildlife Service, for even though it was on, you know, in the park area, because they're the ones that cited him. So he's suing for a violation of Title 8, and there was a court hearing going to happen in 2001. So that happened in 2000. The suit was filed, I think, that fall or early winter, and then there was going to be a court hearing in Fairbanks in I think it was June of 2001.
Okay.
And Dick was living up at Pass Creek at the time, and he had a bunch of chickens, and he had 4 or 5 dogs. So he put all the chickens in these plastic buckets with holes drilled in them, and he was going to drop them off at Last Chance, I think it's Last Chance, what's their names? I forget their names, but those folks that live at Last Chance Creek, up there, he was gonna give his have his chickens and his dogs be cared by Scarlett and Wayne.
Wayne, the Halls.
Yeah. Yeah, and anyway, Dick doesn't show up. He wrecked his boat, and his chickens all drowned and went downriver. His dogs were running the bank and they were all fine, but he ended up being in a drift pile with his boat, and died. And the river was a little on the high side and was a little turbid, so Wayne and Scarlett, he doesn't show up there, right? So they go into town and they talk with Park Service and say, you know, Dick didn't show up, there's a problem, you know. And they're going like, why would we be concerned with schedule a Dick, you know?
Yeah. What,
we haven't ever been in the past? He goes, no, he's got a court date where he's suing the federal government over this. And he was going to bring his chickens and his dogs. And they said, well, we'll fly over and see what we see. Yeah. So they flew over. I think they took a helicopter and flew over the Totonic, and they saw these buckets.
Yeah.
They saw his dogs at the cabin up the river, and he was not there. And so they mobilized a kind of a search for him, and ended up finding him in that drift pile. But apparently there was a whole big contingent of folks from Eagle that went down there to walk through the delta, and they got lost, and the Park Service had to rescue a few people. Anyway, it was a mess.
Yeah.
And it's not a very easy river to move around in or get up past the delta.
Yeah.
But in any case, after that was all, the court case was no more because of the person most affected. So there were a lot of the down and out and conspiracy theorists in Eagle thought that Fish and Game killed him, because you know, they don't distinguish between federal and state.
Fish and Game. Oh my gosh!
To keep him from this lawsuit, we're like, no. So my buddy John Burr, you know, and I told him that, he says, you corrected him, right? It's Fish and Wildlife Service. I said, no, I didn't correct him.
Keep thinking that.
So I know. Anyway, so.
Did he want to be buried?
He got cremated, and so his daughters, he's got two adult daughters, right? And they're going to inherit his scene in Eagle and out there, and they wanted to go up to Pass Creek to spread his ashes to the cabin up there, and so they couldn't get anybody to take him up there, right? And finally Wayne and Scarlett said, we'll take you up there. How hard could it be? And they're 19-foot Grumman.
Yeah.
So they go cruising up the Totonic River. Flip the boat.
Oh my gosh.
And all the ashes are gone.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
gosh.
Scarlett and one of the daughters on one side and Wayne on the other, and Scarlett is yelling at Wayne, and anyway, that they never got up there. But even somebody skilled in boating along the Yukon, that little river is and any of them. It's totally different.
Yeah.
And
what's the key? How do you get up these little, what do you do to, I mean, you bring in a canoe. Like what's,
well, I, you know, I line up.
Yeah.
I can line up, or I take my canoe with the little 8-horse on it. But you have to be aware of, you know, if you got two people, you got some different options, because you can start up a riffle that you can't make it out the top end of. And if you start bumping, the guy in the front can come out and grab it.
Yeah.
But if you're the only one in there, you can't do it.
Yeah.
You'll flip your boat.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you start hitting, there's no way out.
Yep. And you know, all of a sudden, if your front will get pulled one direction.
It'll get pulled one way or the other, and you're gonna roll it. And so you have to know beforehand, you know, is this, if you're one person in a boat, am I going to be able to make this or not? If it's a clear yes, you can go. If it's not a clear yes, though, you have to stop and line it up or pull it up.
Okay.
You just have to do it.
Got it.
And so lining and poling, you know, or paddling is always going to be part of the mix. And some people don't know how to line.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, you know, you want a keel on the boat, and these little motor canoes have a keel. So, you know, you have a line, one end on one side, and the farther out it is to the current, you know, the farther out from shore it's going to be, you walk up.
Yeah.
But it's if you have a motor, then, you know, any place where it's deep enough, you're cruising.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But
when you've gone up the the Kandik moose hunt, can you go up most of it without lining it?
It's variable.
Yeah.
And it's a water level dependent thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're like medium high water, and you know, if unless you see it through cycles, you don't know what that is, but
yeah.
But generally, you know, there's only a handful of places that that I have to line it up.
Last year I went up the Kandik to go pick up we have a wolf den up there by Easy Moose.
It's been there for a long time.
Yeah. Have you walked into it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
Yeah, we've seen them.
Yeah.
And they have a spruce grove that's just totally packed down in the spring.
Yeah.
With all these little trails.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So we went up there last year and got some, put out a camera up at the Wolf Den, and then also I did try to record some howling, so we howled at the wolves. They weren't there, the adults weren't there, but we got the pups to come to us. It ran to us. We got videos of them running.
Oh, really?
Running by. And then they kind of figured out something was wrong, and then they just ran back to their den, you know. So, you know, that day ended kind of early for us. We had stayed at the mouth there at the cabin there. And so we had a collar, a moose collar. A moose died just past Three Mile Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And we got up on that. What's this? Is this Candick? Candick Peak. The Candick Peak?
I don't know that one.
Really? Oh, it's funny because it's called like, let's see, where's...
Is it up 3 Mile?
3 Mile, yeah. So Candick Peak is like right here.
Mm-hmm.
And we popped up on this ridgeline and walked this ridgeline back, and it was right here is where we got the collar.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, and it being like a 13 mile day. We started, I think, at like 2:30 at mm-hmm. 2 in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and got back to the boat at like 11, 12, you know, and then boated the rest of the way down.
Well,
you know, and I remember boating down thinking, because I bumped into you moose hunting and thinking, I would not want to go over this section with a moose in a canoe.
That was when we were headed down.
It's a couple of years before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I was, anyway, it made me think about you and like, you know, I was, you know, I have nice little, this, you know, old little John boat that the Park Service has down there.
Yeah.
And that does great with the 30-40 on it. But it's still like a little like, you know, I guess you're going over these falls.
Well, that 3 Mile Reef is a tough place.
Yeah.
Right now, it can block the jet boats from going if it's a low water. It doesn't stop the canoes from going through, but still, it's kind of a dicey thing bringing a moose down through it.
Did you? Yeah. How did you? Do you float through it, or do you line it down?
I line it down.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Line it, or have you know, with a moose in it, I'll get out there as you're going downstream on the right side, and with a single rope to the front, you know, and just sort of allow it to go down, and then, you know, usually John Burr or Scott McLean, you know, whoever's with me, you know, has a little rope off the side, so that once it gets down to a point where it can get pulled to shore, where we can jump in again, they'll pull it over to shore.
Got it.
And so, no, but that's a tough place.
Yeah. It was dark. It was getting dark, and I wasn't reading the river real well. And, you know, all of a sudden, because I went up it, no problem. Like, and I think I just went up over the falls. And I don't really remember what I did. But when I came back, I was a little surprised that I was going over, like, these rock falls, you know, right down the middle of it, and it kind of just had to go.
You must have had pretty high water. Because lower water, you wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah, and it was spring. I mean, it was, it was, you know what it was? It was it was mid-June, and it was hot.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, I guess it probably would have been melting out. So there was still would have been a little higher water.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't very high, but it was.
So in the past, that was, the river was actually shifted, if you're going upstream, shifted way over to the left. And so there was a reef that even in the lowest water, it only covered about half of the river.
Oh, okay.
And the river has since moved that way so that it covers the whole thing in low water. And
okay.
In high water, you can get by. There's a big channel on the you know, left side going up.
Okay, Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And then you immediately you take that right?
Yeah.
As you're going down, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember, you know, just going over these and then immediately having to skirt right.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a guy out of Central one time, and there were a whole bunch of jet boats lined up right there below the reef because it was kind of low water, you know. And this guy had gotten up through it. He had a blue tarp over his cab, and then just like plastic window plastic,
yeah.
as his front thing, kind of a rudimentary thing, and this old boat with a jet unit on it, and his dog. He had this black kind of lab dog, and he had decided he's just going to go for it, you know. And so everybody else is sitting down there. He goes over and he makes it up, but his engine hit at the last bit and popped out of the thing, you know. So it's this jet engine just going wow. Yeah, but anyway, he went up and we ran into him up 10 miles up the river, and he had his dog, you know, and he would be motoring, his dog would be right out on the front of the boat.
Yeah.
Well, we ran into him later. He had run out of fuel and decided, or was running out of fuel, and decided to go back down to the Yukon. And so going down through the reef, he just gunned it. Well, he ends up hitting this rock right on him, busts in the front of his boat. His dog goes rocketing off the front and lands in the water down below the reef. And all these guys in the jet boats are watching this thing. And somebody from the boat shop was there, and they actually helped him, you know, because he slams into the front of the boat too.
Oh my God.
But they ended up helping him get off and put some, I don't know, a carpet on there with rivets and something, and a little bit of liberal use of silicone,
yeah,
to get it good enough for him to get down to Yukon.
But yeah.
there's some crazy stuff, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Cool.
Anyway, too many stories. Yeah.